I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A former top British official has publicly acknowledged that her own government spied on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Claire Short, who was a cabinet minister in Tony Blair's government in the lead-up to the Iraq War, told the BBC Today program that she had personally read transcripts of Annan's conversations.
Spying is something quite different. Spying in the United Nations is something quite different, isn't it?
Well, indeed. But these things are done. And in the case of Kofi's office, it's been done for some time.
And do you believe Britain's been involved in it?
Well, I know. I've seen transcripts of Kofi Annan's conversations. In fact, I've had conversations with Kofi in the run-up to war, thinking, oh dear, there will be a transcript of this and people will see what he and I are saying.
So, in other words, British spies have been instructed to carry out operations within the United Nations on people like Kofi Annan?
Yes, absolutely.
Tony Blair has called that claim totally irresponsible, but said that to confirm or deny would compromise the British intelligence force. Joining us now is Matthew Tempest of the UK's Guardian newspaper. Matthew, how is this all resonating in Britain today?
Oh, I mean, it's an overused word, but this has been an absolute bombshell. And this was dynamite this morning. And by complete coincidence, today was the day when the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, does his monthly hour-long press conference. And nobody had anticipated this being said on the radio this morning by Claire Short.
We just heard her say that she saw the transcripts. Is she seen as credible?
I think she is, because this actually comes on the back of another court case which was dropped in the High Court in London yesterday from a former UK spy, well, in fact, a translator, but who worked at the eavesdropping base in Britain. And she originally claimed back last year that Britain had been spying on some of the smaller countries in the UN, if you remember sort of Angola and Chile and these countries that the US and UK coalition needed to get the resolution to attack Iraq. And that was a big story which she was prosecuted as a whistleblower for. Now, yesterday, the government decided to drop the case, even though she had pleaded guilty to it. That was a big story. Claire Short, who used to be in the cabinet, coming out today and saying that we also may have bugged Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, is pure dynamite. And so I think the Prime Minister is well aware that if much more comes out on this, it could possibly even lead to his resignation.
You mentioned that Catherine Gunn originally blew the whistle on what was a U.S. request for wiretapping at the U.N. and, as you said, walked free yesterday. Is your sense that's why Claire Short spoke out today?
Yes. What happened yesterday was not that she was found guilty or not guilty, but that the case was withdrawn by the prosecution because her defense lawyers had requested the legal advice given to the Prime Minister on the legality of the war. Now, that has never been released in Britain, and there's a lot of speculation that, in fact, the Attorney General, who is the chief law officer to the government, had originally thought that the war didn't have a legal basis, but changed his mind as the date towards the invasion approached. That's a breaking story over here today, and possibly there's going to be more of that tomorrow in the British press. So that's what led to Claire Short's revelation this morning.
Matthew, a spokesperson for Kofi Annan has said that this spying, if it happened, would be illegal. Is it?
Well, that's a question for the lawyers. It certainly sent all the reporters away this morning scurrying for their international law textbooks. It was put to the Prime Minister that this would be a breach of the Vienna Convention, and the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, really appeared to deadbat that question and just say that he believed the intelligence services always operated within the national and international law. But I think in Downing Street tonight, they will be very worried that if you prove that the government's been conducting illegal acts, then really it's hard to see even how the Prime Minister could survive. I know that sounds dramatic, but yet again, Iraq, just as the Prime Minister tries to move things back onto a domestic agenda, the issue of Iraq in the UK, at least, is just not going away.
Well, quite a bit to digest in Britain today. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew Tempest is with the Guardian newspaper. He spoke to us from London.
There's no smoking gun proving that former Yugoslav leader Slobodan Milosevic committed genocide. That's the conclusion of the prosecutor in the already two-year-old trial of Milosevic before the International Court of Justice. As the prosecution unexpectedly rested at The Hague yesterday, Chief Prosecutor Carla Del Ponte also insisted she had made the case to convict Milosevic on other counts, like war crimes and violations of the Geneva Convention. On the line is Samantha Power, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, and she's founder of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. Hi, Samantha.
Hi there.
Samantha, as you well know, 7,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys died in the town of Srebrenica in 1995 at the hands of Serbs loyal to Slobodan Milosevic. That's not in dispute. So why would it be problematic to bring a genocide trial against Milosevic?
Well, he has a couple things going for him. One, he's a wily chap. He was covering his back. So I think you're not going to find a document where he says, hey, go and commit genocide against the Bosnian Muslims in Srebrenica. So that, I think, is what Del Ponte means by the absence of a smoking gun. The second thing he has going for him is, of course, he's the president of Serbia while the massacre is being carried out in Bosnia. So he has also sought refuge in the plausible deniability of him being in a kind of separate command and control structure. And the third, I think, issue at stake here is that the prosecution is trying to show a kind of systematic pattern of genocide in Bosnia. So it actually is easier to link Milosevic to some of the events in the early stages of the war, like the concentration camps that people might remember, you know, where you had those hollow, sunken, emaciated men behind barbed wire back in 1992.
Yeah.
Those crimes, actually, you can draw probably a thicker line to Milosevic, too, but those crimes are a little more controversial in terms of deciding what is genocide. You know, where does ethnic cleansing end and genocide begin? And genocide is an intent-based crime. So it's not enough to massacre a group of people. The prosecution has to show that Milosevic actually intended to destroy the Bosnian Muslim or the Srebrenica Muslim group as such, which is a much tougher evidentiary burden.
There are 66 counts against Milosevic in all. The trial now recesses for 3 months. A new judge will be appointed, and then Milosevic will be his own attorney when the defense portion of all this begins. What do you think is the possibility that he could get off?
I don't think there's any chance he'll get off.
Yeah.
And I even think that, I mean, there's still a chance that the judges will say, you don't have a smoking gun, but actually we can infer intent from a variety of other documents. So I think it's a big deal that the prosecutor has come out and begun to kind of prepare all of us for the possibility of an acquittal on the single count of genocide. But I think on all the other counts on crimes against humanity, violations of the Geneva Conventions, war crimes, the deeds in question that were committed in Bosnia were well proven in all of the other cases, you know, that the court has seen so far.
What does it mean for future trials? And, of course, one immediately thinks about Saddam Hussein.
Well, because, again, he's in the same country where the atrocities are carried out, and because he's such a ruthless dictator and has such control over all the levers of society, I think that'll be an easier case to be made. But I think it's the right question to be asking, because the bar for what genocide is, not only as a matter of law but as a matter of politics, may well end up much, much higher, which I think will make it more difficult to mobilize political resources while atrocities are being carried out in the future.
Samantha Power, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Samantha Power is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, and founder of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard.
Republicans and Democrats don't agree on much these days, but some members of both parties say they're outraged by Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan's remarks that Congress should rein in the federal deficit by reducing spending for federal programs, including Social Security. While Greenspan supports the Bush administration tax cuts as a means of jump-starting the economy, he says the lost revenue has to be made up somewhere. Lawrence Kotlikoff is a professor of economics at Boston University. He joins us on the line. And Professor, Alan Greenspan is calling for a massive overhaul of Social Security, including raising the retirement age above 67 and decreasing benefits. So first of all, will that reduce the deficit?
Changes in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are long overdue. Unless we do something dramatic and very quickly, we're going to bankrupt the country. What he has in mind specifically is to raise retirement age, as you said, but also to price index the benefits so that the benefits would not rise with wages. They would just rise with prices over time.
And what might this cost retirees? Give us an example.
Well, today's middle-aged worker might end up with, you know, a third less in benefits when he retired. Now, the problem with what he's proposing is that this puts the entire burden on today's workers and tomorrow's children. It leaves the old generations, the rich and middle-class older people now alive, completely off the hook. We have a collective problem here, and I think that the elderly who can afford to help us pay for it should also be asked to contribute.
And further, where is the dividing line? Greenspan said that while wanting a thorough review of Social Security, he says, "I also believe that we have an obligation to those in and near retirement to honor what has been promised to them." President Bush also said, "My position on Social Security benefits is those benefits should not be changed for people at or near retirement." It seems to me that a lot depends on what the definition of near is.
Exactly. If you phase in changes to Social Security too slowly, it won't do much in terms of helping us deal with the long-term crisis. We're going to have baby boomers starting to collect Social Security in about 4 years. Greenspan should have been talking about this 10 years ago.
Well, and as you say, if in fact it's going to have any effect at all, it would have to happen next year.
Yeah, to give you an illustration, if you were just going to use Social Security and Medicare benefit cuts to try to deal with the effect of bankruptcy that we face, you'd have to immediately and permanently cut those benefits by 45%. And this calculation was actually done by Secretary O'Neill before he was fired, and the minute he was fired, it was censored by the U.S. Treasury.
And when we say cut, someone, for instance, who would expect maybe $1,000 a month, and that's high,
would have 45% less.
Right. To live on.
To live on, month after month.
What other options are there?
Well, first of all, we should rescind the tax cuts. We should cut back on the dramatic increases in federal spending that have occurred in the last few years. But we should also dramatically change the way we organize the provision of Medicare and Medicaid benefits so that there's a cap on the total spending on these programs so that they don't put us down the drain. This is the country's, apart from terrorism, largest threat. It will send us right down the tubes unless we really address it and quickly.
Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Professor Kotlikoff teaches economics at Boston University.
Just ahead, in the final part of our series on milk, the all-important taste test. Nothing else matters if you don't like to drink it.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
We've been listening to stories about milk this week. We've looked at the use of bovine growth hormone at conventional versus organic farms and at how one little organic label ended up part of a giant corporation. But we haven't heard about taste. So we decided to conduct our own taste test. We used three brands, one from a big dairy company, one an ultra-pasteurized organic product, also from a big company, and third, milk from a small local dairy that uses Jersey cows instead of the more common Holsteins. We asked our staff to evaluate them, and then, for the benefit of a really expert palate, we paid a visit to Chris Kimball. He's the founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and one of the stars of the PBS show America's Test Kitchen. Before we start with your taste test, do you have thoughts about how milk is supposed to taste?
Well, in our tastings here, first of all, we use about 25 people to do tastings. And the thing we find is people often tend to like the things they're used to from childhood. So if you grew up with non-fat milk, which I did not, or low-fat milk, you probably will prefer low-fat milk as an adult. So one of the things we try to do in tastings is to give people a range of things. We also will put in the same item twice. So if we have 10 milks, for example, we'd have an 11th which is a repeat of one of the 10, just to see how much variance we get in the ratings, so that it should come out the same, obviously. And if it doesn't come out quite the same, we have some idea of the validity of the tests and how much variance we'd expect. But I think milk, I believe in fat, as Julia Child still does. I think milk should taste fresh. It's like a really good yogurt in your mouth. It's lively and sparkling. And some milk just tastes dead to me.
All right, well, let's go to the blind test. We've got several cups of milk here. They're only labeled X, Y, and Z. Start with X.
Mmm. It's almost like cream. Actually, what I do when I taste, I like to taste a little bit of everything quickly.
Y with a palate cleanse in between. Now we're to Z. By the way, as you taste Z, they are all whole milk. We'll let you know that. Is your tasting impacted by the fact that there are waves of garlic coming from a test that's happening in another
part of the kitchen? Oh, no, not at all, okay. I'm sure. Or that I had garlic for lunch or whatever. Do this one more time.
Sure. So you've taken several tastes.
Well, there's some people on our staff who taste things once. I taste it 9 times because I keep learning something every time I do it. Do one more time.
I'd like
this is nothing. You tried the vinegar tasting or the anchovy tasting or the fish sauce tasting. I think X has seems to have the highest butterfat content. It seems richer than the other two. Y and Z are closer together. I'd say Y is slightly richer than Z. So I think they're in order. X, Y, Z. X being the richest, Z being somewhat less rich.
All right. You said X was the
highest fat content.
Highest fat content. Let's see what X was. A reveal, please. X was the small local dairy, Hylon, and Jersey cows.
High fat. Jersey has high fat.
So you're not surprised?
No, I'm extremely relieved, actually.
Okay, you said Y was...
Yeah, it was in between X and Z.
All right. It was the organic cow, organic milk. It's owned by a big company, but it comes... It's a large company, comes from New York, and it's ultra-pasteurized. And now the third, Z, was a staple, Hood.
Yeah, there you go.
Hood, a big company, and likely uses growth hormone in the production.
Well, that goes with what I thought.
Well, now here's something interesting. Our staff, with the exception of one person, moi, did not like the Hylon. You and I liked the Hylon, which is, again, the small dairy farm, the Jersey cows. Let's listen.
X, I didn't like at all. I thought it had a slightly unpleasant odor.
X had a tang to it, and I said artificial. I mean, it just felt different.
There was something thin about that one that I didn't like, sort of gray. It tasted a bit gray.
It definitely tasted, it came right out of the cow, tasted very sour. I didn't like it at all.
Now, we should say that when we did the staff taste test, we used 2%, not whole milk. The Hylon was 1.5%. Do you think that people can actually taste a percentage less?
I doubt it, unless they taste a lot. And my guess is people, I would doubt they would taste the difference between 1.5% and 2%.
Yeah. They just didn't like it, though. Except for me. I loved it. I loved
it. But you know what it is? Milk, I think for a lot of people, milk is not supposed to have flavor, really. You know, you think about it, you're not used to milk having a real taste to it. Someone said it tasted like it just came out of the cow, which I guess for most Americans is not a good thing.
I took Y.
Okay, now we're listening to Y, which is, again, the organic cow.
I thought it was the creamiest tasting and the freshest tasting.
Y was my favorite. It was the most balanced, was full, not too heavy.
Y was very sweet.
It was sweet. It had a nice aftertaste. It made me feel warm inside.
Did you taste sweetness in the organic milk?
It may have been a little sweeter. I mean, it is ultra-pasteurized. I mean, ultra-pasteurized milk, or, you know, is heated to, what, close to 300 degrees or something. It's quite high. And that's, you get rid of a lot of the flavor by heating it that high.
I liked Z definitely the most. I thought it was sweeter, and it also had a nice smell. It just had a better odor than the others.
Z was definitely my favorite. I just found it very, very rich and creamy.
My preference was Z because I thought it tasted the most familiar. Most like milk that I drank, you know, growing up.
I like Z.
Z.
Z. It seemed the creamiest and had sort of a sweet, creamy, nice flavor.
So there you have it. Z, Hood, the large milk manufacturer, probably uses growth hormones in the production of milk, but people loved it.
Well, the key was the individual who said it's what he's familiar with. It tasted familiar, which in our tastings here, we've done hundreds of them. That's the tip-off. People will pick what they're used to. I mean, very often in a chocolate tasting, for example, people often pick Baker's chocolate because they grew up with brownies made with Baker's chocolate, even though it's not the best. People will pick ersatz maple syrup made with corn syrup and artificial flavorings instead of real maple syrup because that's what they grew up with. Obviously, a lot of people like Z because they're familiar with it. Familiarity is what people will go for first in a tasting.
Thank you so much, Chris Kimball.
My pleasure. I've had more milk than I've had in quite some time.
Chris Kimball, founder of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and the PBS program America's Test Kitchen. For more on our taste test and other milk stories, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the American Catholic Church releases a report which quantifies abuse by priests across the country.
There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Researchers have discovered a protein in monkeys that protects the animals from the HIV virus and may one day help prevent the disease in humans. A team of Harvard University researchers at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston released their findings in a study published in Nature. Well, joining us on the line is co-author and Harvard doctoral student Chris Owens. And Chris, can you begin by explaining how this protein works in monkeys?
The protein is actually an intracellular protein, and what it does is, well, what we believe it does, is it interacts with the incoming viral core. So the virus fuses with the cell, releases its genome and core into the interior of the cell, and at that point, shortly after the virus enters the cell, we believe that this protein is either targeting that core for degradation or is somehow disrupting the core's uncoding to release the viral genome to undergo the rest of the viral life cycle.
Yeah, put another way, I've read that the HIV virus, when it enters the cell, it needs to sort of undress itself,
exactly.
The HIV virus does, so that its genetic material can then go into the cell's genetic material, and this protein keeps it from doing that striptease.
Exactly.
It's just a layman's way of putting what you said. And the importance of this is that that's how HIV replicates itself by forcing that cell to duplicate itself. So once the protein stops the HIV virus from ordering that cell what to do, then it's effectively stopped the spread of the disease.
Exactly.
Right. So how does this then help humans?
Well, you essentially block the virus at the point where it generates most of the errors and most of the ability to adapt and evolve. So if you can actually block the virus at an early step, like this protein does, you can't effectively stop the virus.
Right. Do humans have this protein?
Humans do have this protein. The sequence is a little different, and what our lab is now focusing on is trying to identify the main determinant which actually makes the monkey version of the protein a little better than the human version, and so that we can potentially create a human version of the protein that's actually as good or better blocker than the monkey version.
Right. Obviously, the monkey is better because humans get HIV.
Exactly.
Is there any way to deliver this protein? Could you deliver it in a medicine? Could you, any way to deliver it directly to humans?
Yeah, there's actually probably two potential methods for delivering this protein. One would be through gene therapy, which is, at this point, really an unproven technology, and there's just a lot of controversy over it. But the other way would be to actually incorporate that protein into some sort of a liposomal delivery, some sort of a vesicle,
You take that amount of protein, you coat it in fat, and then you inject that into a human. And then presumably their cells would fuse with these fat-coated, you know, proteins. And for one, the proteins would be protected from the immune system by the fat shell. Mm-hmm. And then the proteins would be delivered into the interior of the cell where they could actually do some good.
Right. Well, I imagine you're going to get your doctorate.
Yes. March 25th, I'm defending my thesis and hoping to be all finished.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Chris Owens is a doctoral candidate at the Harvard Medical School.
After 34 years of research and nearly 5 years after the New York Times raised a false alarm that a cure for cancer had been found by a doctor in Boston, Dr. Judah Folkman's discoveries have now led to a drug that appears to stop the growth of colon cancer. The FDA is expected to approve the drug Avastin within weeks. Joining us is Dr. William Lee. He's president of the Angiogenesis Foundation in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Bill.
Dr. Lee, Avastin is from a class of drugs called angiogenesis inhibitors. Can you tell me what that is?
The term angiogenesis refers to the growth of new blood vessels in the body. This is a normal process used for wound healing and reproduction. But it's also a common denominator in disease, where diseased cells can hijack this process and grow new blood vessels as lifelines to the diseased tissues. So angiogenesis inhibitors are a way of cutting off the blood vessels feeding disease. It's sort of like cutting off the air hose of a scuba diver.
You cut off the blood flow to diseased cells and kill them.
Or to control them, which mm-hmm. is more the point.
Okay.
Angiogenesis inhibitors were once regarded as a potential way of curing disease, but a more scientific way of thinking about this is controlling their growth. Without oxygen and nutrients, disease cells can't grow. So angiogenesis inhibitors are designed to control the growth of disease by cutting off their blood supply.
I see. So now Avastin, the FDA is expected to approve it within weeks, because it does what we were just talking about to colon cancers, prevents them from growing. If you can do that for colon cancer, why can't you do it for any other cancer?
Well, theoretically, angiogenesis inhibitors will find a use for virtually every cancer that's known to man, because all of these tumors require a blood supply in order to grow larger than 5 millimeters in diameter. That's about the size of a grain of rice. And if we could keep tumors that size, we might be able to just let people live their normal lives without ever making cancer a significant health issue for them. Now, Avastin is significant because it is the first of many angiogenesis inhibitors, but it's the first to prove in large-scale clinical trials that by controlling the tumor's blood supply, that this can help cancer patients live longer and live better.
Dr. Lee, this is extraordinarily important news, isn't it?
I would say that it is as significant for cancer in much the same way that new drugs like antibiotics opened up the new gateway for controlling diseases that were once thought to be uncontrollable, like infections. But Avastin is the first of many to come. In fact, that the Angiogenesis Foundation has been tracking all these inhibitors in development, and currently there are more than 74 different angiogenesis inhibitors in human studies for cancer alone.
How quickly are these other anti-angiogenic drugs expected to be out on the marketplace?
Right on the heels of Avastin are 8 other angiogenesis inhibitors in the final stages of development. And there's another one called PTK-787, which is an anti-angiogenic pill. Avastin is an infusion, but this pill is also showing great promise for treating colorectal cancer. So should the FDA approve Avastin, we would expect to see this new treatment called Avastin available within the year. But I think within the next couple of years, we'll start seeing these other drugs beginning to prove their worth. And of course, there's a gold standard. They have to show in phase 3 clinical trials that they are capable of improving care. And that's the bottom line.
Dr. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Dr. William Lee is president of the Angiogenesis Foundation in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more information, please check out our website at here-now.org.
Still to come, the latest music from the Tarbox Ramblers.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our segment with Doug Hadaway, former spokesman for then-presidential candidate Al Gore, on the impact of Ralph Nader's current presidential run brought this response from Rich Calvin of Stony Brook, New York. Al Gore lost the 2000 election because he ran an out-and-out horrid campaign, also because of legal and illegal contrivances by the Bushes. To listen to Gore's mouthpiece shift blame onto Nader without challenge by Here and Now is galling. While I disagree with Nader that there is no difference between Gore and Bush, there are certainly profound similarities, which only Nader has been willing to discuss. And believe me, we need that discussion.
After the death of Patrick McSorley, a well-known plaintiff in the Catholic Church sex scandal, we spoke with McSorley's friend and attorney, Mitchell Garabedian, prompting Lynn Polino of Wellesley, Massachusetts, to call.
Please continue to give interviews like that about the clergy abuse problem, which is still going on. As he said, the church is a secret society, and a lot more needs to be done in reparative work and honesty and transparency. Keep up the good work.
Samuel Matthews, a dairy farmer who listens to Here and Now on WHYY in Philadelphia, responded to our series on milk and the use of the growth hormone, BST, by many American dairy farmers. He writes, I think BST should be called a production hormone rather than a growth hormone because it doesn't stimulate growth of the cow, just production of milk. I have never used BST. I use a robotic milking system, which I believe relieves the utter discomfort felt by high-producing cows while at the same time giving a production bonus equal or better than BST.
Ned Hanauer of Framingham, Massachusetts, took issue with our interview with David Twersky of the American Jewish Congress. We spoke to Twersky about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. Ned writes, Twersky repeatedly implied that European critics of Israel and Zionism are reflecting anti-Semitism. For balance, Here and Now's listeners should know that millions of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish Europeans and their counterparts in the U.S. and Israel deplore both racist hatred of Jews and Israeli policies which deny Palestinian Christians and Muslims human rights.
Many of you responded to our interview with theater critic Bill Marks on bad journalists making for good theater and films. In our introduction, we said that Jason Blair, Stephen Glass, and Janet Cook were, among other things, plagiarizers. Paul Marsh of Weir, New Hampshire, wrote to correct us. According to my dictionary, he writes, plagiarism is copying from someone else without giving credit. Whatever these folks did, who'd they copy from? Well, it's true the term plagiarism does refer to those who steal another author's work. And in most cases, these three writers were found to be fabricators, making up stories and passing them off as the truth.
And finally, listener Jeff Bateman wanted to know what that song was that followed our thoughts on the end of Sex and the City. Well, it was Bjork's version of the song, It's Oh So Quiet.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
You wanna love, you wanna cry, you crush your heart and hope to die.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Thank you.
Already Gone, the opening cut from the new album by the Tarbox Ramblers. Which does raise the question right away, what's a tarbox? Well, it turns out this hard-rocking, rootsy, blues, and even gospel-drenched band isn't referencing some obscure country backwoods thing called the tarbox. It turns out the band's lead singer and guitarist and composer is Michael Tarbox. Simple as that. Michael joins us in the studio. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
The album is called A Fix Back East. It's your second album after your really widely acclaimed first album. The first album was mostly covers.
Yes.
This one has eight originals, including Already Gone, which we just heard, and the title cut, A Fix Back East. And let's just quickly hear a bit of that spooky tune, A Fix Back East.
Can't stand a surprise in the weather your eyes. There's a line, live with the beast. My heart's exploding, I'm expecting left. A fix on me in the east. I need a world that's turning. I need a world that's burning. I need a world I'll fade away.
Gritty, raw, like a lot of this album, Michael. Sounds like it's straight out of some backcountry gin joint, but you're actually Boston, actually Cambridge, to be specific,
sure.
Case. How'd you find your way to this sound and song?
I think it's a mix of, you know, my influences and the people I play with, and having made the decision to write some songs. I mean, it all kind of comes together. So
you recorded a lot of the album in Memphis with the great Southern producer, Jim Dickinson, who's worked with, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, a few other people. How did Dickinson approach the sessions? Did he bring any particular approach to how you'd cut this thing?
Yeah, he did. One of the things he said to me when I met him is that he enjoyed recording people who had never met before working on music they'd never heard before. Mm-hmm. And somehow I just get the sense that he had a strong sense of the moment, which is kind of the way I approach things, too, in terms of recording, that you just want something fresh and something unexpected to happen. And that's why I went with him. A lot of the stuff we recorded, it's, you know, first and second takes. Uh-huh. And most of the original songs that we recorded were things that I introduced in the studio to the guys in the band. We didn't play those on the road beforehand or anything. So and I think that Jim was the guy to record a band working that way.
A lot of it has a real feeling of being kind of night music. Do you write at night?
No, I write in the morning. Huh? I write very early in the morning, like at 6 in the morning. But it's funny that you should say that, because I think of all of the songs on the record happening at night, or almost all of them. There's something – I agree with what you say. I think the mood is – very late night.
I mean, a lot of the album is very, very driving and bluesy and rootsy, and has almost a rock quality to it. But
sure,
it's quite a shift from your first album,
sure,
which was covers and was almost garage bandy. Right?
Yeah, I think it's really important to take chances, and I just wanted a different feel. I think that it was important to get different tempos and different sounds and all of that. So we thought we'd take some chances and see what we could come up with.
Michael, one non-original on the album is a great kind of country rock shuffle, country blues. Let's hear a little bit of it. Why did you choose it for the album? Country blues.
Well, the author is somebody named Doc Boggs, who's a hillbilly musician from Kentucky. And he wrote and played some amazing stuff. He died in the 60s. And, I chose the song. It has this sort of a bleak mood to it. I love Doc Boggs. I just love his singing and his playing.
Tell me a bit about Michael Tarbox. Where'd he come from? Have you always made a living at making music?
Oh, no. I mean, I've had a number of different jobs. I've worked in factories and driven cab and worked in kitchens. I did some freelance editorial stuff for a while. I've had a variety of jobs. I grew up right around here. My dad grew up
Boston area.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad grew up 5 minutes from here.
Another cut, Cloth of Gold, to me brought to mind a kind of cross between something as bluesy and rootsy as Charlie Patton, but also Bob Dylan, which we'll talk about in a second after
sure.
we listen to Cloth of Gold.
Save yourself, save yourself.
Are you conscious of reaching back to somebody like Charlie Patton when you write a cut like that?
Well, I mean, I love Charlie Patton. I mean, he's been certainly been an influence on me. He's one of my favorite musicians. But I'm really not trying to reach back to the past. Mm-hmm. If anything, I'm trying to just establish our own sound. I mean, I think that's really important. So I don't have any sense of trying to. Bring you know somebody that's my influences into the fore. I'm trying to do my own thing.
The album to some extent did resonate for me. A couple of the cuts, particularly Cloth of Gold,
yep.
with Dylan, what he's done on his last couple of albums, particularly
yep.
Time Out of Mind.
Thank you.
Who are the musicians playing on it? They're terrific.
Well, there's Dan Keller plays fiddle, Johnny Shasha plays string bass. And we have three drummers joining us. One, the guy that joined us in Memphis is Alan Scheinfeld, who's a great drummer. R.L. Hulsman plays drums in a couple of cuts, and Howie Ferguson plays drums in a couple
of
cuts.
You know, Michael, you say you've had a lot of jobs. You're making a living from it now, but you're not as rich as Bob Dylan.
No.
what keeps you going?
I don't know. I mean, it's sort of, I think, a combination of just... blindness and some desire to explore things. You know, I mean, I think you kind of have to have a blind spot to continue as a musician in a way. I mean, the money's not great or anything, but it's just what I do.
Well, for anybody who listens to the Tarbox Rambles for the first time, I think it might be an eye opener. Any song you'd like to go out on?
Yeah, we can do No Night There, which is an old gospel song that we found.
When you walk up to heaven and knock on that door, there will be someone to greet you on that strange and distant shore.
Gospel, blues, rock, it's all on the new album from the Tarbox Ramblers. A Fix Back East is the name of the CD. Michael Tarbox is the singer, songwriter, and guitarist. Michael, thanks a whole lot for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
There is no night there. There be no more pain. Be no more fear. In that city over yonder, these things will
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
No need to fear. It is always open, and there is no night there.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.